Good evening and hello. I'm Lisa Desjardins. Jeff Bennett is away. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, news from the front in Ukraine as Russian forces make significant gains in the east and ramp up attacks on civilian targets. Then, nearly a year after the Taliban takeover put their lives in jeopardy, we look at the effort to help female judges escape Afghanistan. And what does it mean to be American? On this 4th of July weekend, we take a look at how Americans see their country and identity.
All we have to bind us together is this creed, this set of ideas and ideals and promises that from the beginning we were breaking, and from the beginning we've never fully lived up to.
All that and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. Good evening. We begin tonight with news out of Ukraine, what may be a major shift as Russian forces take over a pivotal eastern city.
For Russians, a high priority, as Moscow claimed full control of the eastern Ukraine city of Lysychansk.
As a result of successful offensive actions, we have closed the encirclement around Lysychansk. The Ukrainian troops are completely blocked in another cauldron.
But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, meeting with the Australian Prime Minister in Kiev, insisted the fierce fight for Lysychansk is not over yet. The city of about 100,000 people is the last major Ukrainian stronghold in the Luhansk province. Its neighbor, Severodonetsk, another critical city, was taken by Russia a week ago. If Lysychansk is seized, it will bring Moscow one large step closer to its goal of capturing all of Ukraine's Donbass region. More than 100 miles northwest, residents of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, are cleaning up after a 4 a.m. rocket barrage that damaged homes and a school. One family credited a pet with their safety.
There was just a cherry tree and a fence. Now the fence is destroyed and there is no cherry tree. My wife was lucky that she woke up early in the morning because the roof fell exactly where she had been sleeping.
The dog saved you?
Yes. It didn't let us sleep the whole night.
In some other parts of the country, Zelensky yesterday said that life was beginning to return to normal. But he urged his people not to forget that the battle for Ukraine still rages.
In many home front cities, there is now a feeling of relaxation. But the war is not over. The war continues. Unfortunately, war is only increasing in some places. Do not forget about it.
Police in Copenhagen, Denmark, say several people are dead after a shooting earlier today. A 22-year-old man is in custody. Mallgoers were seen fleeing from the Fields shopping mall. Other images show victims being placed on stretchers. Police say they have not ruled out terror as a motive. Akron, Ohio residents are absorbing new, difficult video released today of a police shooting. Jayland Walker, a 25-year-old black man, was shot and killed by Akron police on Monday. A warning, some of this video is disturbing. Police say the incident followed an unspecified traffic violation. It ended with a group of police officers opening fire on Walker as he fled. Police confirmed more than 60 gunshot wounds on Walker's body. He was unarmed when shot. There was a gun in his car. Protesters took to the streets as Walker's family questioned the police's actions. The eight officers involved are on leave pending investigation. At least five people are feared dead after a glacier collapse triggered an avalanche in the Italian Alps. Dramatic cell phone video shows ice, snow, and rock cascading down the mountainside. Helicopters and dozens of emergency responders continue to comb the mountainside for survivors. Responders believe that as many as 15 hikers were in the area at the time of the collapse. Tens of thousands of people are evacuating their homes in and around Sydney, Australia, following torrential downpours and flash floods. Streets resemble rivers, and aerial footage captured entire suburbs underwater. Australian emergency services say they conducted over 100 flood rescues in the last 24 hours and responded to thousands more requests for assistance. And more heavy rainfall is expected in coming days. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the global effort to rescue Afghan women who used to be judges from the dangers of the Taliban regime. And on this Independence Day weekend, what does it mean to be American? A conversation you shouldn't miss.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade has raised some concerns outside of the medical realm about data privacy. Just this week, Google said they will automatically delete abortion clinic visits from users' location history. But it's not clear how quickly that will happen or whether other information like search history or use of specific apps will also be included. Correspondent Ali Rogan recently spoke with Rebecca Wexler, assistant professor of law at UC Berkeley, about protecting this type of personal data.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us. There's been a lot of discussion about deleting things like period trackers, apps like that, but I know that you've been talking about how this is much more pervasive and is also a matter of controlling the data that we use on all kinds of mundane apps that people use every single day.
That's absolutely right. The conversation about period trackers is essential, but it's a tiny piece of this bucket of data that we're generating. It's our location information, our web search histories, our purchase histories, our unencrypted chat messages and our emails, communications data, associations data, where we sleep at night, our heartbeat data. All of these kinds of things can be used to criminally prosecute people who are seeking abortions.
And that's a really daunting list that you just mentioned. So what should people be doing to try to protect themselves and their data?
If you are vulnerable, at risk for an anti-abortion prosecution, don't use the internet to seek information. Leave your phone at home when you go to seek medical care. But really what we need is for tech companies to step up and protect users' data, not be collecting, not be storing, should be purging data, should be giving users rights to remotely delete data, should be foregoing using analytics to predict pregnancy and abortion. What we need are those commitments from tech companies, not to volunteer the information to law enforcement, not to sell it to data brokers, not to traffic in it. That's what we need.
We know that there have been cases of tech companies clashing with law enforcement previously over privacy rights. Where do you see this conversation going? Where do you think some of these tech companies are going to end up based on their actions that they've already taken in other cases?
Just as you've said, they've done it before. So an example, Meta just won a case in the New Jersey courts where they challenged the scope of a warrant that was supposed to be executed over the course of 60 days. That was far too long. So there are examples of companies successfully pushing back, even at the extreme of a law enforcement warrant, and not having to hand over information. I think we should hold companies to that standard. You know you can do it, you've done it before, you should be doing it here. But in addition, stop volunteering information to law enforcement. Promise that you won't voluntarily hand it over. When law enforcement comes and asks for information, notify the people whose information is being requested.
There's already also been a lot of questions about how these laws are this patchwork of laws is going to make sense state by state. And so I wonder, how do you see that question about enforcement over state lines playing out when it comes to these questions of data protection?
Yeah, so there's some really tricky jurisdictional questions about whether law enforcement in a state that's criminalized abortion actually can compel disclosures from somebody in a state that that permits abortion. And I think tech companies need to put their litigation weight and their well-paid lawyers behind challenging law enforcement demands for information from service providers who are located in pro-choice states.
Rebecca Wexler, Associate Professor of Law at UC Berkeley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Following the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the country saw sweeping reforms, including in its courts, with the appointment of more than 250 female judges. But with the final withdrawal of U.S. forces last August and the takeover of the Taliban, many reforms were reversed, putting the jobs and lives of these female judges at risk. Special correspondent Christopher Booker reports on the ongoing effort to help those judges get to safety in a new country.
The story behind this seemingly simple moment is a tale comprised of a remarkable set of circumstances. And for Judge Vida Kayumi and her family, it started with only an hour's notice.
We didn't ever think that the Taliban will come to capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, in just one day or 2 days. On that Sunday, 15 August, we went to our office as usual. We were immediately told we were being let to go from our jobs.
The dismissal of Judge Vida Kayumi and her husband, Prosecutor Hamayoun, was just the beginning of what would be a seven-month journey.
We came home and we get the girls and just two backpacks. We knew enough about Taliban behavior to realize we could not stay there, and we were into a hiding for 1 month.
Judge Kayumi and her family made it out of Afghanistan and landed in Doha, Qatar. From there, they went to a U.S. military base in New Jersey, where they would stay for 4 months, and now are in temporary housing in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. All this time later, the family is a portrait of what has been lost in the new Afghanistan. But they're also a bright spot in this terrible story, part of a global rescue effort to find safe passage for Afghanistan's 250 female judges. In August of last year, NewsHour reported on the frantic effort to get the country's judges out of the country as the Taliban closed in.
Everything that a woman judge is anathema to the Taliban ideology.
Judge Vanessa Ruiz is a senior judge on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. She is also a former president of IAWJ, the International Association of Women Judges, a coalition of 6,500 female judges from around the world. In 2003, the group started working and supporting female judges from Afghanistan.
They represent everything that the Taliban do not want women to do or to be. The last time the Taliban were in control in the 90s, when they took control back then, the judges were the first women that the Taliban went after to remove them from their positions.
On Thursday, with the help of interpreter Farah Arjan, we spoke with three judges desperately trying to get out of Afghanistan. For their safety, we're not sharing their names or showing their faces.
So the Taliban knows about our whereabouts. They already have gathered all the information they need. So there is no way for us to hide, or there is no way for us to stay, and we have to find ways for us and our family to find safe places.
Is the only solution to leave?
This is obvious, and you see what is going on, that the Taliban is coming to Kabul. They are going to kill us, but also our families, and it is creating a lot of stress for us.
The three judges we spoke with in August were among the few who successfully escaped at the beginning. They are currently living in Poland.
Since then, over a period of months, and in a very painstaking, difficult, with at times harrowing experiences for the judges, we have been able to assist about 172 judges and their families to be evacuated.
The judges and their families have been scattered all over the globe, but the effort helped rescue nearly 1,000 Afghans. But there are still 79 judges in Afghanistan.
The situation there is becoming more difficult. Every day there's more violence. There seems to be more violence directed against the judges. And so we're very worried about them. They continue to be in hiding. The Taliban, as you know, has come down harder on women generally. They can not travel more than a certain distance without a male companion. They must be fully covered. And of course, they can't work. They have received no compensation, any of these judges now, for months and months and months.
Where does the U.S. government fit into your thinking? And has that changed?
The U.S. government, from our perspective, was truly absent at the beginning of this whole saga. As far as the women judges are concerned, I think that has changed. And we are now quite hopeful that there will be a path for a number of the judges to come to the U.S. But the process is intensive, exhausting, and it takes time.
Is money the main concern, constraint, or is it bureaucracy, logistics?
It's all of the above.
Of the 172 judges the IAWJ helped escape Afghanistan, 12 have been permanently resettled in the United States.
In addition to the loss of life, what has been lost in Afghanistan?
All of my kids are girls, and it will be a nightmare, and it will be a scary time for me to see that my girls will cannot attend the school after the age of 12. Of course, it's very hard to accept that we lost everything that we had in less than 1 hour. But the greater picture is that we have lost a whole generation of female lawyers, judges, professionals, and academic of all kinds. We are the place that's not the place that they can live anymore because of the threat of Taliban.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Christopher Booker.
Finally tonight, the Declaration of Independence's words are timeless. We hold these truths to be self-evident. But in this time of stark divisions, is it self-evident what it means to be an American? Ahead of the 4th of July holiday, we reached out to Americans, some we met on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., others who spoke from their homes, to talk about how we see ourselves.
What does it mean to you to be American?
I think to me, being American is being free to express myself. It means community.
I think, obviously, you know, hard work is a part of that. I think looking out for your neighbor.
I want to feel proud of my country right now, but it's hard to. With all the history we've been looking at, it's feeling like we're repeating history again, like the same struggles I thought we would be over. And as an American right now, it feels conflicting to be an American right now for me.
We all are American. It doesn't matter where you're from, where you came from, because again, everyone's immigrants unless you're Native American.
Being an American means freedom to me. Freedom to have an opinion and to voice that opinion.
I wish America would heal, and I wish that, you know, everybody can unify and we can all come together, but I don't really see that happening right now, and I see a lot of division.
Everybody says we're divided, but I don't. I see it as part of the process of the political system. I don't feel as though we're as divided as the media makes us out to be.
You know, we got opportunities, and you know, if you come to America, it's a lot of opportunities of being prospering United States, and it's to be thankful, man. That's all.
We still have the ability to live our dreams, pursue happiness. It's not perfect, but it's a blessing to live here.
July 4th, 1776, my people and people look like me were on a plantation, so we weren't free. So to me, it's just another day. I don't feel any type of way.
Anybody who looks realizes that it was Independence Day for rich white males who owned land, and it has taken us all these many years to actually reach something near independence for people who are not straight, people who are not white, people who are not male.
To me, it's a day of remembrance. It's a day of sacrifice. It's the day the sacrifice began to create this country.
I don't know how much we have to really celebrate. I, for the most part, have been celebrating Juneteenth since 2020, and I think I'm going to continue to do that.
Well, it means seeing my family and remembering all those people who fought for us to have freedom.
Part of being an American is acknowledging where we have fallen short and then having that optimism that someday maybe we'll get there. Someday we will fully realize these wonderful principles that were included in our founding documents.
For more on what it means to be American, I'm joined by Eric Liu. He's the CEO of Citizen University, a nonprofit organization that teaches civic empowerment. And Sadia Khan, she's the host of Immigrantly. It's a weekly podcast that focuses on the experiences of people who immigrated to America. Thanks to you both for joining us. And Eric, let me start right off the top. You spend a lot of time having this conversation about what it means to be American. Are there things that people agree on right now about what that means?
Well, I think you heard some of that in the clips you just heard from people all around the country. And one of the themes that I think you can draw from that is that on some fundamental level, what it means to be American is to forever be contesting what it means to be American. We are a country that is drawn not from a single bloodline, not from a single faith in a single God, not from a single history on a single piece of soil. All we have to bind us together is this creed, the set of ideas and ideals and promises that from the beginning we were breaking and from the beginning we've never fully lived up to. The point isn't for us to get to some magical consensus that all Americans believe X or all Americans think this way. America is an argument. And the more that we can get comfortable as Americans recognizing that from the beginning we were meant to contest the tensions between liberty and equality, between strong national government and local control, between a colorblind approach to law and the Constitution and a color-conscious one. All these tensions are baked into our whole system. And even though our politics is toxically polarized right now, we don't need fewer arguments right now. We just need less stupid ones.
Saadia, you chose to become an American. I'm wondering, what did that mean when you first became an American citizen, being an American? And what does it mean to you now?
It's such a difficult question because for me, being an American is reconciling so many different parts of my identity, right? So reconciling part of my Pakistani identity, my American identity, it's a balancing act. And there are times when I feel more American, and then there are other times when I feel less American. For instance, when I became a citizen, I felt more American. There was a lot of hope. I felt like I had made it, quote unquote, made it. But now, almost 9 years after my citizenship, I feel less American because I see so many racial and socioeconomic inequities. And I see that in a way we are regressing. And that is hurtful and it's painful as a naturalized citizen. And I'm also trying to navigate my own place in America as a Muslim, Pakistani American, first generation woman of color. And that's becoming harder now than it did, say, 10 years ago.
I'm curious what you make of this idea of a conversation. If Eric is right that America is an argument, is that an argument that is worth having, or has the argument gone too far into conflict?
Absolutely. I think it is worth having now more than ever before because there are so many different narratives that we see, right? So people like myself, we have decided that we cannot sit on the sidelines anymore, and we are part of that political and social discourse. We are part of that argument. And to Eric's point, I totally agree because I feel America is work in progress. So absolutely, yeah, we need to have more arguments than less.
You know, America is changing. Our demographics are changing for sure. We're becoming more diverse. We also have a lot of disparity in this country too. Is there an identity crisis because of these ideas?
Let's look at the three of us right now in this conversation, not only at the beginning of the country, but even 50 years ago. For the three of us to be composing a conversation about the meaning of American identity would not have been the default setting of national media. And here we are, right? And I think the reality is that we are living through this time where whiteness and Americanness are at last decoupling. And people are scared of that in some ways. People are hopeful in other ways. But the thing that we are forced to reckon with right now is that we've got to come together to define a notion of Americanness that is not based on the default setting that to be American is to be white and to be American is to be male. We're not a white monoculture, and we're not some multicultural color-coded collection of different pots of culture. We are a relentless hybrid-generating garden that is just yielding all kinds of ways of thinking, believing, praying, eating, imagining, creating that the rest of the world hasn't yet contemplated. And that is our competitive advantage in the world right now. I'm the son of immigrants from China. And I will say very simply that as strong as China may be getting and as powerful as they may be, the United States retains a deep and enduring competitive advantage, which you can boil down this way. America makes Chinese Americans. China does not make American Chinese. China's not interested in trying to take people from other parts of the world, bring them in and integrate them and give them a chance. That is precisely what's happening here in the United States. And this combination of people like us right now and others who are trying to give new life to the ideas and the ideals of the American creed, that is the essence of both the challenge and the opportunity right now.
Eric Liu, thank you so much. Saadia Khan, thank you too for having this conversation this holiday weekend.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show. I'm Lisa Desjardins. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, and have a good 4th of July.